Welcome to Hub Headlines. Today's program features the best commentary and analysis published in the Hub for April 19th. Up first is Derek Hunter, writing on slower growth, fewer jobs, a worse economy, and why the consequences of the capital gains tax shouldn't be shrugged off.
Trevor Toom has laid out a vigorous defense of Chrystia Freeland's budget 2024 decision to hoist capital gain inclusion rates for corporations, trusts, and high-income individuals. In his essay, the good professor illustrated the mathematics involved when a corporation incurs a capital gain and then passes the proceeds on to its shareholders. The example depicted the concept of integration, which has been a hallmark of the Canadian tax system for decades. Integration refers to the idea that the corporate and individual tax systems should be indifferent to whether an investment is held in a corporation or directly by the taxpayer. The same concept applies to dividends. It is the reason why the dividend tax credit exists. Without integration, some investment strategies would be favored over others, so conceptually, it is pretty difficult to argue with. It is when he takes the concept one step further that academic theory collides with real-world investment decision-making. Toom goes on in his piece to rely on the old economic canard that a dollar is a dollar and the economy is indifferent as to whether it is collected from an individual or a corporation. In other words, the income tax dollar collected from an employee should be taxed at the same rate as the capital gain earned by the investor in order to avoid advantaging certain taxpayers over others. This line has been repeated many times by academics and wage earners in the wake of Budget 2024. That indifference may well be true for the Canada Revenue Agency, but it is certainly not true for the entrepreneurs who start companies or the investors who finance them. The company that I lead has been one of Canada's most active early-stage investors over the past decade. Last week, we made our 100th investment in a seed-stage technology company. The large majority of these are located in Canada. We treat this business seriously, and for our efforts, we have been recognized with a number of awards, including being named Canada's Angel Investor of the Year for 2019. There are three main reasons why the dollar that we earn from our investment activity is not the same as the dollar earned by a typical employee. These boil down to risk, liquidity, and the time value of money. 1. Risk. We make our investment decisions knowing that every individual company in the asset class has a 75% to 80% chance of failure. Loads of studies show that the large majority of early-stage tech companies fail to return their investment capital. Investments in the minority of companies that succeed have to be sufficient to carry the load of multiple failures. An employee earning regular income in a job bears no equivalent risk. 2. Liquidity. When we invest in a startup, we expect that the holding period will be between 7 and 10 years. Over this long period of time, it is very rare to have the opportunity to swap our position for cash. We are truly locked in until the point where an exit is achieved, even if we identify better opportunities for the cash. This contrasts starkly with the employee who will see cash for his or her efforts within 2 weeks. 3. Time. With a holding period of a decade or so, it is very easy to see how inflation erodes the real value of an investment, even when nominal returns may look marginally acceptable. Let's say inflation averages 3% over the 10-year period. At the end of the 10-year holding period, the investment would have to increase in value by nearly 75% just to keep pace with inflation. In this illustration, a $100 investment that becomes worth $175 has produced no real return, yet the capital gain tax is levied on the nominal return, i.e. $75. The investor owes $25 in tax on an investment that has produced no real return at all. Indeed, the tax has actually put him into a loss position. Again, this does not happen to an employee who is paid every 2 weeks for labor supplied and bears no such risk. For us, investing in early-stage companies is exciting and rewarding, but it is purely profit-seeking. While this is not a charitable activity, the investments that we make along with our partners do have the delightful side effect of creating thousands of jobs and hundreds of millions of dollars of annual economic activity. The creation of economic opportunities has always depended first and foremost on the prevalence of creative entrepreneurs and those that invest to support them. All net new jobs come from startups. It's the best recipe for economic development mankind has ever invented, and 13 million private sector jobs in Canada owe their existence to this sort of activity. But ask yourself why anybody would ever take on the risks associated with early-stage investing if they were subject to the top marginal Canadian tax rates, which exceed 50% in most provinces. The government has a larger claim on your efforts than you do. If your choice is between a GIC paying 5% per year with no chance of loss or a startup with an 80% chance of failure that might produce a multiple of that in 10 years and then be subject to the same rate of tax on a nominal return, you probably would take the GIC most of the time. Another economic adage is that if you want less of something, tax it more. That is what Freeland and Company have done this week. Canada is already experiencing a well-documented productivity crisis, with GDP per capita declining over the past several quarters. By reducing capital availability, this latest budget will only accelerate that ugly trend.
That was a commentary by Derek Hunter. He is the CEO of Blue Sky Equities. You can find the full text of his article on our website, thehub.ca. Our second essay is by Peter Weltman, writing on how events define political leaders. For Prime Minister Trudeau, the main one may be housing.
Ah, governing. It's about responding to the events of the day, even if as a Prime Minister you came to office with a very different set of objectives. The first chapter of this year's federal budget on housing is a terrific illustration of that. Over the course of my career, from my time at the Treasury Board Secretariat, the Parliamentary Budget Office, and most recently as the Financial Accountability Officer of Ontario, I have read a lot of federal budgets. But I don't remember any budget dealing so extensively with housing. But why now? It was not long ago that Prime Minister Justin Trudeau commented that housing was not a matter of federal jurisdiction. But events happen. When UK Prime Minister Harold Macmillan was asked what was the greatest challenge for a statesman, he replied, "Events, dear boy, events. A government's ability to effectively respond to events is what we as electors are counting on when we elect one." The housing affordability crisis that we now face has been roughly 20 years in the making. It was about then that housing supply started to lag housing demand, and the gap has been rising steadily ever since. The gap has largely been attributed to the lag in supply. Others have written extensively on how that's been allowed to happen, including a 2022 report by the Province of Ontario's Housing Affordability Task Force and the Smart Prosperity Institute. The report outlined 55 recommendations to increase the attainability of homes for rent and sale across the province. Our ability to fix the housing crisis is not a newfound thing. All levels of government have had the tools to do so, but events got in the way. In the early 1990s, governments were running very large deficits, to the point that those deficits became unaffordable. The event of the day was to get those deficits under control. As a consequence, the federal government stopped funding social housing in 1993. Provincial governments started to download social services to the municipalities, which included affordable housing. So housing supply at the lower cost end of the market started to dwindle. Fast forward to this current Liberal government's term of office. When the Trudeau government swept into power in 2015, among its many priorities, renegotiating NAFTA was not in their election platform. But with the election of Donald Trump as U.S. president, the government faced a critical test. The most important relationship for our economic growth and well-being was threatened. The renegotiation of NAFTA was a huge effort. I knew people intimately involved. It was a full-court press from all levels of government and from all parties. There wasn't much disagreement on its importance, and behind the scenes anyway, it was almost a nonpartisan issue. When building their next platform for the 2019 election, the government could have never predicted the event that was the COVID-19 pandemic. Much has been said about COVID-19, but the aftereffects were also unplanned. Because governments around the world shut down their economies, supply chains got backed up, so economies suffered from lack of many things, from toilet paper to airline travel. Because most people were still earning an income or being supported by a government program, there was still a reasonable level of spending in the economy. The resulting increase in the inflation rate was something we hadn't seen for almost 40 years, yet another event. To tame inflation, the Bank of Canada raised interest rates to their highest level in about 30 years. All of this happened just between 2020 and 2024. Oh yes, Russia also invaded Ukraine. This was the first time a European country invaded another in many decades. The other event has been a very significant increase in the rate of immigration. We live in a country whose fertility rate is lower than the replacement rate. We depend on immigration to support economic growth, which in turn helps governments pay for things like education and healthcare. However, unprecedented levels of immigration have also put a lot of strain on all government services and housing infrastructure. These services have not kept pace with the level of demand for many years. My assessment comes down to economic incentives. Those who currently own a home and benefit most from the rapid appreciation in housing prices are, by coincidence, the same people who have a significant degree of control over how much and what type of housing gets built. Compounded by a rapid increase in Canadian immigration is the significant population migration to large urban centers over the past quarter century, adding pressure to urban planning. In Canada, and especially in Ontario, land use planning, the function of allocating land for housing and employment, is notionally under provincial jurisdiction. However, the nuts and bolts of building permits are actually handled at the municipal level. I have been fortunate, in my role as a member of the Peel Transition Board, to learn a lot about these nuts and bolts. And what I found most acutely is that, up until 20 years ago, planning departments actually had a culture of enabling housing. But that culture has changed to one that now inhibits housing growth. Given that municipal governments are highly responsive to their local constituents, why would this be? Political science teaches us that it is easier for constituents, be they individual cities or larger entities, to influence their political decision makers in a smaller jurisdiction than a larger one. As a result, city councillors are very attentive to the needs of their constituents. This is a good thing in a democracy, but when it comes to housing, it has resulted in not being able to see the forest for the trees. When it comes to housing, the result I've witnessed is an undue focus on protecting the character of a neighborhood. This has meant protecting the value of the existing housing stock at the expense of making more housing stock available, at a more affordable price, to accommodate and encourage population growth. When we price people out of the housing market, they will eventually find somewhere else to move. When we live in a country whose population is aging, this puts added pressure on government-provided services such as healthcare and pensions. When we live in a country where the natural rate of population growth is below the replacement rate, we rely on immigration to ensure population growth, economic growth, and an increase in our standard of living. We, who have benefited from the rapid appreciation of the value of our homes, are dependent on the next generation to provide for us, as our productive capacity starts to decline along with our health. This is the forest. Our home prices are the trees. Events. The federal government is trying to address this latest event in its budget. From a government whose prime minister at one point did not consider housing to fall within his jurisdiction, to now that same prime minister who has put forward a wide-ranging set of policies designed to increase housing supply and to try to make housing more affordable for future generations. Let's see if it works.
That was a commentary by Peter Weltman. He is Ontario's former financial accountability officer and the former senior director, costing and expenditure management to the Parliamentary Budget Officer. That's it for today's edition of Hub Headlines. We hope you enjoyed the program. To receive all our best commentary and analysis each morning by email, subscribe to the Hub for as little as 25 cents a day. You can do that right now at thehub.ca. Hub Headlines is produced by Alicia Rao. Thanks for listening.